From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Christian Rutter, co-founder and president of OkCupid, the huge online dating site, raised a lot of ire this summer when he unapologetically trumpeted that his company, quote-unquote, experiments on humans. He's still licking his wounds from the kickback on that. But Rutter's bigger interest, he says, is the enlightenment about ourselves that the ocean of data accumulating online can provide. Know thyself, he's saying, on a whole new scale, on big issues like race, gender, and yes, sex and dating. This hour On Point, seeing ourselves in online data. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Christian Rutter, co-founder and president of OkCupid and author of the new book, Dataclysm, like cataclysm, but data, dataclysm, who we are when we think no one's looking. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Christian Rutter, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. I'm very glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. You made quite a ruckus this summer with your Yes, We Experiment on Humans headline. We'll talk about that. I mean, that really got people's attention. But take us to your big thesis first. We all thought we were just putting all kinds of stuff up there at OkCupid or wherever it may be. And yeah, there's some things are true and some things are lies. And maybe it amounts to something and maybe it doesn't. You're making an enormous claim here that we are collectively, in the aggregate, learning more about ourselves that we've ever known. Let's hear, how do you put it? What are you claiming?
Well, you know, OkCupid started in 2003 and went live in 2004. And, you know, we had spent years at this point. When I first started thinking about this stuff was maybe 2009, 2010. And at that point, we had spent years with all this data and using it to understand people, you know, because that was our business. We're trying to bring two people together. We're not really trying to sell anybody anything. You know, we show ads and stuff, but we're really just trying to find matches. And so we'd use all this data. You know, we want to know what people like, what they hate, how they describe themselves, what makes them similar, different, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it occurred to me we were finding so many interesting things. It occurred to me that other data sets, like Facebook's, obviously, or Twitter's, could answer similar or complementary questions, kind of fill in the gaps where we didn't have information. And I dug more into it, and I saw that there were a lot of people doing work like the work that we were doing internally at OkCupid on those data sets. And so I wrote Dataclysm to bring all that stuff together. And you know, at the time I started the book, it was like right when Facebook's IPO was about to happen, and everyone was talking about how rich all their data was going to make everybody. And I just really felt there was a bigger part or bigger story to tell than the money. You know, I wanted to tell the human interest, the sociological side of things, because they're just, you know, to the extent that we live our lives through these technologies, we can then kind of go back and look at how we live.
We're going to look at what you are saying here, you know, that we may not know about ourselves, but I don't think you quite laid out the full enormity of your claim in this book there, Christian. I mean, when you say dataclysm, you're talking about kind of cathartic cataclysm of insight that
sure.
When all of our sort of secret knowledge of ourselves or things we don't even know about ourselves but get revealed through all this data are laid out, and suddenly it's a kind of mass enlightenment of the planet occurring. I mean, that's not that far off from what you're saying here.
That's true. I will say, you know, I really have tried to – I have one foot, obviously, in the technology world. I have another foot in the kind of skeptics camp. You know, I'm kind of I'm not trying to be an evangelist for anything. And the angle that I take in the book is like, I think that's where we will be, you know, 25 years down the line. These technologies are way too young. They're too little understood, or people have had too little time to both generate and analyze the data that's being collected for there to be this kind of awakening now in 2014. You know, and I wrote the book with an eye towards the future. Of course, I wanted to get people thinking about where things were going, but where things are right now, you're right. There isn't going to be this full 360 degrees, full spectrum understanding of people just from what they're doing on Facebook. And
but we want to understand the tallest poles in the tent you're putting up here. This awakening, we'll poke around at the present, but
sure.
What's your claim about the awakening that the data mass on the internet may portend for the human future? 25 years is not that far away. What's the awakening you sort of imagine here?
Well, you know, in colleges or research laboratories all over the country, there are thousands, tens of thousands of people working to understand how the mind works, how society works, how our emotions work, all of this stuff. And right now, heretofore, they've been using surveys or kind of contrived lab environments. And very soon, if not already, you know, they can actually, if they want to know how life works, human life works, they can actually go look at how life happens rather than trying to simulate it or make a guess or have people tell them what has happened. And it's just so much more powerful when
you But wait a minute, what questions. Do you mean by that? Go look at how life happens. You're oh. saying that what happens online is how life happens?
I mean, in narrow senses, for sure. Yeah. I mean, you can answer questions about what people find attractive. You can answer questions about how friendship networks work or how news travels through communities. Mm-hmm. You can answer questions about how, you know, how sexual attraction affects job prospects. You can answer questions, even just a very material real-world question of like where people are moving. You know, Facebook's data scientists have because, you know, their reach is incredible. They have 1 billion people log in every month. So that's just 1 in every 7 people on Earth. You know, they can go look and say, well, we see how there's this phenomenon called coordinated migration where kind of villages all over the world, but, you know, in Southeast Asia, for example, big cohorts of people move together to the big cities, you know, to Bangkok or, mm-hmm. or wherever. And that's the kind of thing that happened in the U.S. in the Great Migration in the early part of last century or the kind of manifest destiny of maybe 50 years before. You see these phenomena that for us in the U.S. are in the past, but that are happening in real time and with in a way that we can now go back and understand them in a better detail.
Christian Rutter is an author of Dataclysm, a kind of cathartic mass insight that we'll get, he says, from aggregate data online, make all sociology look like Stone Age stuff to date. Tell us some things that we don't know about ourselves that you already do at this point from looking at the data at OkCupid, your site, and beyond, Christian.
Well, excuse me. I mean, each person will find something different, surprising, obviously. That the most surprising thing in the data for me, you know, Dazed and Confused is one of my favorite movies, and Matthew McConaughey, Wooderson, his character, his name Wooderson in the movie, you know, he says, that's what I love about these high school girls. I keep getting older, but they stay the same age. And it was really surprising to me to see how true that was, that kind of that is how men look at women. You know, the ages that I looked at were 20 to 50. Mm-hmm. And for every single age in there, all 31 of those years, men all found 20, 21-year-old women the most attractive, which is pretty shocking, just in its like sheer uniformity and defiance of biology.
So no matter what their age, within that very large bracket, they always looked where?
As young as possible.
And women? Is it the same?
No, women have a much more sensible approach, you know. There, like, if a 25-year-old woman, the most desirable men are around 25. For a 30-year-old woman, the most desirable men are around 30. To 35-year-old woman, most desirable men are around 35. It hits a wall around 40. So women who are 45 or 50, they still prefer a 40-year-old guy. So you could say a guy is sort of over the hill at 39 or 40, which is I just turned 39. So there's that.
Okay, so we're weighing this. I mean, you've got the data now to prove this, though it's something the popular culture pretty much nails that as well about
sure.
men. Tell us something else we might not know without your aggregated data.
Well, that technology like Twitter, it's not making people worse writers, so to speak. You know, if you go back and look at what people are actually saying to each other on something,
we thought it was all abbreviated.
Twitter.
You know,
yeah, LOL and OMG and all that stuff, and of course those things do appear, but. Both I looked at this data and then independently I found research by other people and it doesn't seem to be the case at all. If anything, the writing on Twitter is more sophisticated. Like the word length is longer than even in like Shakespeare. It's longer and on Twitter by a lot. Like I think it was 4.8 characters per
We're
word.
We're all becoming Shakespeare's out there. So we write
sure.
longer than we thought on Twitter. But go deeper on human nature. Tell us something deeper that you're seeing in the data.
Well, I mean, you can look at Facebook networks, you know, social networks, and I think if one part of human nature that OkCupid is completely blind to is how marriages work. For example, there are very, very, very few happy marriages on OkCupid, to say the least, right? Because everyone there is looking for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a couple of Facebook scientists looked at networks of married people. And they found this kind of counterintuitive fact. You'd think that the kind of the most, if you're looking at the kind of a couple's collected network, you'd think that the strongest network would be a situation where it's sort of a honeycomb, like they have lots of friends in common and all those friends were friends and kind of a community. They're part of a very densely intertwined network. And that actually is not the case. The strongest marriages are not like that at all. They're in fact more of like a hub where the couple kind of acts as a focal point for all these different cliques, and the cliques kind of only know each other through the couple. Which to me was like a really counterintuitive and kind of surprising finding. And then when I went back,
spread your friends out a little bit. Don't share all the same social set.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Are sociologists buying your assertion that you're going to, you know, turn them into the Neanderthals of analyzing human nature? That you're racing ahead of them, or are they there with you?
They're with us. I mean, I'm definitely not saying that I know more about human nature than a trained sociologist or a behavioral scientist. I mean, we work this. I see this data furthering work that those people are doing by and large. I mean, we work with sociologists. I mean, we get data requests all the time. We accommodate as many as we can. I mean, obviously anonymous and aggregated, of course. But, you know, I've worked with many, many academics. Facebook, I think because they sort of have a different system, and certainly stakes are higher over there based on everything that they're collecting. They've brought all the academics in-house and are doing really high-quality research with their data, with, you know, world-class data scientists and academics.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the co-founder of the big online dating site OkCupid, Christian Rutter, about all the data about us out there and his call to use it like crazy, to analyze it, learn from it, to learn all the secrets of human nature. His new book is Dataclism, Who We Are When We Think No One's Looking. Christian Rutter joins us from New York. Lots of calls for you, Christian. Tim, in Providence, Rhode Island, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just would like to sort of pose the question of how accurate people's portrayals of themselves are on the internet. It seems like we sort of put all the good parts about ourselves on the internet and not the bad. And for example, I have a good friend who, she doesn't have a Facebook. But when we both meet the same person, we perceive that person differently because I see their Facebook profile and she doesn't. And she's always surprised. Say she's looking over my shoulder and she says, "Oh, you know, that's someone I met, and that's not how I saw them." So,
and Tim, do you think who's got the better insight about these people? She with her Facebook perspective, or you with your in the flesh perspective?
It's in the flesh, certainly. I think is more accurate.
It's a tremendous point. It goes to the sort of dynamics around all this data online. I'll take it up with Christian. If I may, Tim, I got a little sound here from somebody who may share your perspective. This was from last month. Comedian Jimmy Fallon made an online dating joke here talking about the lies that go on online.
Well, this is kind of cool. I saw that they're bringing the 1950s game show To Tell the Truth back to television. It's good. It's a game where almost everyone is lying, and you have to guess which one isn't. Or as we call that now, online dating. And it's just similar.
Christian Rutter, Jimmy Fallon, and our caller Tim want to know, what about the prejudices or the sort of twisting of presentations of self that go on online? Do they wholesale corrupt the data that you want to analyze to tell us about ourselves?
Well, I mean, I think it's a great question. And no doubt people misrepresent themselves. But I think that actually speaks to the real power of this stuff, because we get the stuff that I analyze in the book isn't what people are saying, you know, about their income, for example, or whatever, about what they believe. It's what they actually go out and do. So on OkCupid, you know, if you ask people, hey, is interracial marriage okay? Do you want to date someone who's only your race? All these kind of like racist type questions. Their answer is uniformly. And in fact, over time, are getting less and less racist. And but if you go look at who they message, there is just a persistent and steady, you know, bias against our black users by people. So like people do misrepresent themselves, but I get a chance to compare that self-representation to what they then go and do. And I think that speaks to why academics are so interested in our data, because there's just a known problem in sociology called social desirability bias, where people always want to say the most desirable thing, even to a computer. They want to tell a computer the thing that makes them look good, but certainly to a human, ask them a question, you know, do you use drugs? Have you had an abortion? All this kind of stuff. You know, people are always like, no, or they give the answer that makes themselves look good. Here, increasingly, with these data sets, we can go look at what actually happens, which is, and then compare the two, which is awesome. But, you know, people definitely lie on OKQ, but I think I went back and looked. We have more millionaires or self-professed millionaires on OKCupid than exist in the United States, and most of them are like 18 or 19, so there you go.
Let me ask you about the ratio there, because everybody knows that people do exaggerate or puff themselves up in online dating profiles. But you're saying that's not the only source of data that is going to be interpreted here, and a lot of it is by what we do, not what we say. So is the puffed up portion that our caller Tim and Jimmy Fallon are talking about, is that 5%, 50%? 80% of the data that from all over the place that people are going to be turning around to interpret us with?
Oh, I stayed away from self-professed data in the book. You know, I didn't look at income because people just lie about that. I didn't look at how tall men are because I know, at least if you compare them against, you know, the Centers from the CDC's information, men add about 2 inches to their height uniformly. So I only looked at the kind of observed stuff. I didn't really look at the self-proclaimed stuff. And most data sets or most of the data science being done is the same way. I mean, except where you're explicitly looking at what people are saying about themselves kind of as the point of the research, you know, but none of this stuff is taken for granted or taken literally. We look at what people do, who they message, who they vote on, or who they like, which is what we call voting on OKCupid, what they decide to share in the case of Facebook's data, and who they decide to be friends with. I mean,
where you click, not so much what you say, but still,
yeah, sure.
You can't help
that's
but wonder. Christian, stand by in New York, Miami Beach, Florida. Hector is calling. Hector, you're on with Christian Rutter.
Christian, first of all, great talk. I mean, very great conversation here. I think your information is going to be very insightful and useful. The book, Data Gratitism, if I got it right, I'm definitely going to look for it in the shelves. I have a quick question. Did you take any accountability to the fact that most flirtatious married people most likely are to exaggerate their present situation, because there was a part of the program in which you said that the most married people are unhappy. I tend to disagree with that. I just think that there might be at an advantage point exaggerating their situation so they can gain sympathy and allegiance for the cause. Because nobody's going to come in the room and say, hey, by the way, I have a beautiful marriage. I just want to see if I do this fling thing, you care to participate. And then afterwards, you know, I say hi or bye or whatever
right,
it is.
Right. Hector, I think we've got it. I mean, there comes the question again of whether people bend or twist their reality, their circumstance to be successful in the mating game on your site, married or not.
Well, yeah. I mean, just to clarify quickly for Hector, like I meant most people who are married and then also on OKCupid. I think it's fair to say that either they have an open marriage or they're unhappily married. Certainly, general data about married people, OKCupid is a terrible source, and I don't use it for that. But yeah, again, like we look at what people are doing, not what they have to tell us about themselves, what they profess to be doing. And I think that's that more than anything is the unprecedented power. And like, you know, Tom, you're kind of hyping up the sort of transformative, brand new world type of thing. And to be clear to everybody, I don't think that that's here, because I'm the first to admit that these are very narrow findings. I tried to collect as much interesting and powerful stuff in the book as I could, and I think it's full of it. But there isn't no one's going to come away with it as like, oh my God, I understand people so much better in toto. I think I want to, but I do think that that's where it's going. Especially
Christian,
when the
be fair to yourself. I'm not hyping. I'm describing exactly what you're writing about where this is going. Why did you call this book Dataclysm?
Well, it's a pun, obviously, on the word cataclysm.
Yes, and why did you pun on cataclysm?
Because it's the old Testament word for, or the Greek word for the Old Testament flood, and it, that for flood, I kind of think of it in two ways, that there's a flood of data coming through. I mean, it's just an insane amount of information being stored. And then also it has that washing away or that transformation. It is going to transform science. It is going to transform our understanding of ourselves.
You're comparing it literally, specifically to the flood in Noah's Ark in here. So who's going big, Christian? Come on.
Fair enough.
You're calling this the flood of Noah's flood here, transformative. That's your description. Of course it's not here today. You're saying that's what's coming.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Pretty big. Our callers are interested in whether or not it's going to be a really good presentation of who we are, if it's going to be transformative. I mean, you said that with mating and marriage and all the rest, OkCupid's mission comes into play here. But doesn't every online player who's connecting data have a mission? For that matter, a profit motive? Can't or won't that end up affecting the way they collect and see the data that comes to them?
I think in certain environments, the data is obviously used to make money. I mean, we all know that. Facebook.
That's the reason it's up there. You sell
right,
ads
sure.
against it. Facebook chops
sure.
it 17
okay.
different ways.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. So there is that. But I think, you know, especially speaking to the kind of experiments uproar that you've referred to a few times, you know, Facebook announced that they had done an experiment on their newsfeed thing and it caused a lot of outcry. But I think lost in that outcry is the fact that Facebook has bothered to go create a world-class academic data team to look for stuff that's just of meaning to kind of human knowledge. You know, there's no profit that they get from publishing these papers. If anything, it causes them grief, right? And OkCupid partners with academics and tries to help them answer their questions. And I think that's the separation. You know, obviously, Facebook does use data to advertise. OkCupid does use data to get people to use the site more and things like this. And you know,
Wait a minute. Your experiments, which you admit to, and theirs, which they were found out on, are not academic exercises. They're in the pursuit of more profit. They want to understand people so that they can know how to get them to spend more time there and how they can get them to click more and like more and all. They said so when it came out.
Sure.
You did this experiment, which got people up in arms, which was take people and instead of matching them up with people who they're compatible with, match them with people that they're not compatible with by your formula and see how that works out. People got pretty outraged by that, saying, "Why you're sending us off in these wild goose chases of, you know, relationships that you can see, at least by your own formula, are not going to work. What's up with you guys? It sounds like Frankenstein."
Well, yeah, you're right. These experiments are done with business in mind, obviously. You know, Facebook isn't a charity, neither is OkCupid. Mm-hmm. But I think there are worthy and legitimate academic findings that come out of them almost as a byproduct. And I think that's what this book is about. To speak to the OkCupid experiment, I mean, we did. We altered our algorithm for a very small number of users. Then we let them know after the fact to basically kind of replace the normal OkCupid match percentage with a placebo. And match percentage is our guess. It's our opinion of who we think is going to get along. And, you know, if you think in the real world, there are lots of what I call heuristics or algorithms that, mm-hmm. that just normal people use to figure out who's going to make a good couple. I mean, you have birds of a feather. You also have opposites attract. Mm-hmm. You have the kind of old world way of like two people from kind of similar, you know, quote, good families. Let's set them up, you know, and there's just thousands of ways to decide.
Upstairs, downstairs attraction and all the rest.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we're refining, we're testing different ways. You know, Match.com uses a completely separate algorithm than we do.
But you don't promise your users will mess with you. You promise we'll look for compatibility. And you broke that promise in your experiment. You make no apologies for it.
We say we use math to get you dates, I think is the tag.
I think the presumption is pretty clear that's embedded in that. And you turned it upside down to play around and see how it worked. It actually worked out all right, at least for
starters.
Yeah, it
did. It worked out all right. Exactly. Like, the experiment could have gone completely differently than it went. I mean, it could have been that our kind of inversion of match scores for those few number of users found way better matches, you know? And in that case, like, we have done the promise that we make to our users that we'll do everything we can to find them someone to go on a date with. Part of that is testing different ways to figure out who they're going to be matched with.
But most people looked at that and said you've got a sort of freakishly Dr. Frankenstein lack of concern about your, we'll play with you this way, we'll play with you that way. We know human nature like never before, and we're going to play with it.
Yeah,
we're gonna play with you.
I understand and don't begrudge that takeaway. I mean, part of that is because I wrote up those results on our blog, which is cavalier and meant to be humorous. And I think people who came to that particular post without the context of all the other posts on that blog, I think very understandably were like, what the hell is going on at OkCupid when they read the post? I mean, I that's totally justifiable. And if I had it to do again, I would have explained it better and chosen different words. But I think there's something... The big positive for me that's come out of this whole thing is that people are talking about this stuff. I mean, obviously, they were talking about it a little bit before with Facebook's experiment. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's the users are all OkCupid has. You know, we're not in the business of doing things to mess with people or hurt them or any of this stuff. I mean, anyone in my office, we have 25, 30 employees. I would immediately fire them if they were doing something to harm our people, you know?
You're not in that business, except when you are. We experiment on human beings, is the headline. Christian Rutter, kind of, which is, he wouldn't have written it that way. The new book is Dataclysm. Don in Miami. Don, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Christian, perhaps you could share some insights of the actual findings that you've made. I'm sorry to say I found what you said this morning rather tedious and boring because it's all a bit theoretical and way over my head. I'm just a simple person. Would you be kind enough to give us some insights apart from the fact that us men prefer 21-year-old women?
Yes, please. It's great. Let's go right on down that list. Christian, lay it out.
Sure. So, when you look at... attractiveness patterns by race, you find that, and this is on a huge sample of the single people in the U.S., you find that black, both men and women, receive a steep discount from everyone else. Asian men are also kind of penalized by the sort of dating public. You find that kind of quixotically that those penalties aren't in place in other places like the U.K. or Canada as much. You find that... that men and women judge each other very differently, and especially insofar as like sex is on the table as a question between them, that women are much harsher than men in their judgments. You find that and then this is just moving out of online dating. You find that kind of this that a single misstep on Twitter can explode. Just kind of beyond a single person's ability to understand it. You know, there was one woman who tweeted something pretty dicey, to say the least, and she was called in front of 60 million people in 24 hours.
Don's question, you've got some others here that go beyond on OkCupid as well, on Google.
Yeah, for sure.
The most common word to follow the phrase, is my husband, ... The most common formulation is my husband gay? 10 times more common than is my husband depressed?
Yes, the Google work is I'm adapting work by this guy Seth Stevens Davidovitz who works at Google and analyzes this stuff just like I do at OkCupid, and you know he's found that exactly what Tom just said. He's found that if you go through and you look at the 2008 election cycle, you can see searches for the N-word peak. Every time something good happens to Obama, the searches go way up, and they've reached an all-time high in the history of Google Trends on November 5th, 2008, the day he was elected.
I just don't follow that. You got one from Facebook as well. The pattern of likes, you say an algorithm can determine with 88% accuracy whether you're straight or gay, just from your pattern of likes on Facebook.
Sure. Right. Exactly. And
60% of the time can tell whether your parents were divorced before you turned 21 from your pattern of likes. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. There's some amazing stuff. I mean, I tried to avoid the kind of statistical dog and pony show, and every person will find different things surprising, but I think the book is full of stuff like that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the co-founder of the big online dating site OkCupid, Christian Rutter, about all the data about us out there and his call to use it like crazy, to analyze it, learn from it, to learn all the secrets of human nature from it. His new book is Dataclysm, Who We Are When We Think No One's Looking. Dataclysm, kind of coming from a cataclysm, the Greek word for the great flood. Insights that he says may wash away more limited understandings of human nature and bring us, one day, maybe, on the back of all this online data, to a whole new understanding of ourselves. Camille is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Camille, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, and thank you again for always such wonderful programs. I have a question regarding an interpretation, your guest's apparent interpretation of some of the data.
Mm-hmm.
Preference versus prejudice in terms of who people want to date. People apparently identify themselves as not having any racial preference or being prejudiced. And in the comment I heard from your guest, he kind of correlated those two things as if, let's say I've never found someone from Guatemala I was attracted to, I would therefore be considered having prejudiced views towards Guatemalans.
Yeah. Camille, if you'll stick with us, let me put it to Christian, but stick with us, Camille. This was your point. If I say I'm not prejudiced, but on OkCupid I'm flipping right past all you said, black or Asian American males or whatever it is, and Camille's not sure that that's prejudice. Maybe that's just preference.
Sure. I mean, to be clear, what I found on OkCupid was that, black people received from the community, you know, about 25% fewer likes, 25% fewer messages. Their messages are replied to 25% less often. And I do acknowledge that sort of preference, you can prefer one type of person as kind of your type or whatever, and obviously not be a racist at the same time. But I do think there are lots of times in life that are like dating that aren't exactly dating. I mean, this is the OkCupid data is kind of the data of the first impression. You see someone's photo, you see a few lines about them, and you make a judgment and you move on. You're a stranger. You don't have any other information about this person other than what you see in a very superficial way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of times in life that are like that, a job interview. You're applying for a loan, kind of almost any time you kind of put on a nice shirt and are like, I'm going to go in and get this, you know?
Yep.
And in many press interviews that I've done, I normally wear a t-shirt, but I'm like, you know, I can't be a slob. I got to put on a nice shirt. I got to shave and all this stuff. And like, there's a lot of times where that gloss, that instinct that you want to communicate or draw out in someone else is important. And I think that this data, it's so deep, it's not just on OkCupid, it's on Date Hookup, which is a site that is far over indexes for Latinos and blacks, for example. It's a completely distinct user base.
Mm-hmm.
Other sites in our portfolio have the exact same patterns. It's not just kind of one time, one thing on OkCupid.
And you don't just call it prejudice even, you call it racism.
Well, I think my theory, obviously, I think that it reflects... It's kind of a white privilege type of thing, although it's not just white people making these judgments. It reflects a common thesis about what is beautiful that I think America has generated. You know, it's mm-hmm. that whiteness in a certain sense, but just non-blackness is more attractive than blackness. And at least that's what I see in the data. And I read a book while I was writing my book, called The History of White People, and it kind of gives this kind of the idea of the quote Caucasian race isn't that old, and people generated it because some guys were walking through the Caucasus Mountains and were struck by how beautiful these people were, and they're like, that is the white person, this beautiful, you know, aquiline nose, you know, all of this stuff, you know, and I think that's what you see in these data sets.
Shaping our cultural understanding. Camille, what are you thinking of that? One by one, you could call it preference. If you've got a whole lot of data, do you share the conclusion that it must be racism, Camille?
Absolutely not. My first name is, I go by my middle name because my first name is so unusual. I don't get job interviews, et cetera, stuff like that because So in a weird way, I've been a white person sending in black people resumes. So,
okay.
So I have a certain level of sensitivity about this. However, I do not believe essentially what your guest is saying. I mean, I feel that like he's flipping this a little bit. I don't feel I was a communications major. I understand what he's saying entirely. There may be factors involved that just comfort. Because the question should really be, would you be interested in heading into an interracial relationship? Because that is far more difficult than dating within one's own race.
But Camille, his whole point is that if you're asked that question in our culture today, you're likely to say, oh, no, I'm okay with that, I mean, more likely. But in the privacy of your own, you know, interaction with an online site where nobody's looking over your shoulder personally, you may do something different.
Exactly.
Do you want to head into something more difficult? or easier. And that's not prejudice. That is.
That's a subtle and interesting distinction.
How much do I want to devote to the potential problems that are already going to be there? And I don't see that as prejudice.
Christian, what do you say? Thank you, Camille. Christian?
I mean, I'm definitely not here to accuse any one person of anything. I mean, the heart wants what it wants, period. And I see Camille's point entirely and leave it to any individual to figure out who they're attracted to. But I think there is a societal or society-level force in play that makes blackness less desirable, less attractive, you know? And I can see it in the data. And I think, you know, interestingly, the caller is subject to that herself. She acknowledges it. She changes her name when she's applying for jobs to not seem black. But people who skin, you can't change your skin color, you know? And my point is that immutable thing does affect, and you can't change it, and it is going to affect how your online life goes for sure, and probably how these kind of in-person interactions go as well.
Laz in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for calling, Laz. You're on the air.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Welcome to Second Hour in South Florida, Tom.
Wonderful to be with you, Laz. Wonderful.
Yeah. I want to just make a quick point, a quick question. My point is I want to recommend to all your listeners to go to Facebook and to read the terms and conditions of your relationship with Facebook. It's jaw-dropping, and I'm not going to go into specifics, but I recommend everybody should do it. My question is
meaning, Laz, that you're just pointing out that they can do almost anything they like with the data that they collect off you, which is deep and wide.
Well, what's really scary is when you put you're on vacation, Facebook and everybody else around the world knows you're on vacation, and that's a pretty scary thing to let people know you're not home. But that's just one example. But yeah. My question is that, you know, I go to OkCupid, and I put in all my personal information because I want OkCupid to help me find a mate quicker. I go to Netflix and I enter what movies I like because their algorithms are always giving me suggestions. My problem is what's being done with that information after OkCupid uses it to help me. Is OkCupid selling that information? And if not, does OkCupid's terms and conditions, do your terms and conditions say that you will not sell my information, or do they give you permission to do so, whether you do or don't? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Laz. Christian?
Sure. Our terms and conditions are probably just as deep and wide as Facebook's, honestly. We do allow ourselves a wide latitude of what we do, and we do not sell data to advertisers. We work with academics on questions that we've been talking about here on the radio. And that data is always anonymized, aggregated. Laz could never be pulled out of this thicket. It's a huge lump of indivisible, you know. It's a huge lump of data that no person can be pulled out of.
Well, they can be pulled out as a unit to be targeted for certain ads.
Oh, that's in the advertising case. I mean, this those are different. I mean, just like on TV, you know, advertisers want to find 25 to 44-year-old women or something like this, and they advertise on the Oxygen Network. At least for OkCupid, the advertising kind of demographic requests that we get are not any more complicated than that. Facebook might be doing something different, but that's basically what we do.
But you and others write that those terms and conditions give you the latitude to do almost anything with the data. And you write, what's being collected today is so deep it verges on bottomless.
Yeah, it's true. It is true. It is true. In terms of the research that's done, both to make OkCupid better and just kind of the human interest type stuff, that's kind of thing, when you buy a movie ticket, your purchase gets folded into that week's box office top 10. Or when you applied for college, you know, your freshman class, or when you went to college, your freshman class, your college took that data, aggregated it, SAT scores, class rank, gender breakdown, race, and, you know, took it to U.S. News and World Report or whatever. So it's not that different than that in terms of how any one person's privacy is being violated by this work. It's just that you get a lot more interesting stuff. Now, granted, that is because people do submit more of their lives to a site like Facebook or OkCupid than you did even to your college in the application process. And to his point, you know, I agree. I would never put that I'm on vacation on Facebook because that, you know, that does expose you to some kind of bad actor that doesn't work at Facebook, a bad actor out there in the real world looking at your Facebook page and saying, oh, Laz is on vacation. I guess I know where I'm going today. Go look at his house, you know? Yeah. And so, like, it's it's hard for me because I do understand the misgivings and I understand the anxiety and I know that this stuff is very new. And I don't post that much to Facebook. I don't really use Twitter personally. But I see that there is a lot we can learn from these kinds of things.
Laz in Fort Lauderdale, I'm with you. When you check the box that says agree on terms and conditions, you are signing off on a lot, verging on bottomless in terms of sharing, Christian Rutter writes. We're talking about Christian Rutter's new book, Dataclism, Who We Are When We Think No One's Looking. Brian in Austin, Texas. Brian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hey, Tom. How are you doing?
All right.
Good. Just wanted to make a point and then ask a question. The author is touting the large amount of information that's going to be gathered and that is being gathered, and that this will lead to new insights into human nature. And my thought is that probably what will happen is there'll be more data, obviously, but we'll probably end up, in terms of interpreting that data, we'll probably fall back upon theories of human nature that have been propounded by, you know, all the great theorists. Some theorists of human nature in the past, ranging from Plato all the way up to Freud and whoever the latest theorist is on human nature. So they'll probably, our prospects of actually finding something new, I think he might be a little bit too sanguine on that. And then the question that I had is, I've been curious about this with respect to young women for quite some time, and I was wondering if there was any data that he had reviewed that might give an answer to this. And to put it in a nutshell, it's why do so many young women seem to fall under the sway of, for lack of a better way to put it, kind of a knucklehead in terms of a guy? I think you all probably have a sense of what I'm talking about.
Brian, you've got two great big questions there. My goodness. Aristotle, Plato, and knuckleheads. I appreciate your call from Austin. Our time begins to grow short. Christian, how about the second one first? I don't know how you interpret knucklehead, but...
Yeah, we haven't found a way to quantify knuckleheadedness yet, unfortunately, and feed it into our algorithm.
Best shot, though, on Brian's question on that front. That's interesting.
Well, I mean, the thing that I'm just trying to think of what personally for me goes into a knuckleheaded dude, you know, overconfidence, always thinking that you're right, which I guess is kind of the same thing, and an overbearing personality with a lack of any self-understanding. And those are exactly the kinds of things that go over well on a first date or in a loud bar. The kind of more you shout yourself out there, the more people are going to hear what you got to say about yourself, you know? And I think that's a big effect, certainly in the old world of offline dating. That's why you see the kind of like big beefy meatheads bring home the girl, so to speak.
And it may bleed over into online dating as well.
Well, online is a little different. I mean, and I say this as a person who at least has written a book, if not is a writer. It is a writer's world. You can write a message that in theory will be better than the knuckleheads. It's the whole experience is mediated by words. Your whole online experience is mediated by your words.
But you also say that the photograph totally swamps words, that the words almost don't count compared to the picture.
Certainly for the first impression, yeah, you're exactly right. So you still got the battle. You've at least got, once you do get someone's ear, so to speak, you can, you know, then hopefully the greater intelligence of the non-knucklehead will take over. changing human nature is not in my job description, unfortunately.
And what about Brian's thought that no matter what we learn from all this, this great flood of new data, we will likely pour it into old vessels here, into the thinking of Plato and Aristotle and Freud and you name it. Or do you see a breakthrough possibly?
Well, I think that's a great observation, and I really like that he brought up Plato and Freud and the history of thought, because I tried to fold that into the book myself. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say with a straight face that any person looking at this data is smarter than Aristotle or Socrates or Plato. And I think a lot of our kind of received wisdom down the years is going to be proven correct. There's a reason that wisdom still exists. But some of it won't. Some of it will be overturned, and we'll be able to address new questions. Like, I mean, Plato... as intelligent as he was, he wasn't able to go look at what people say and then what they go do, you know, in this race example that we were talking about with Camille. So there are new vistas that are opening up that even the best minds of years past were not able to see. And I think, you know, and I think that's why I'm so excited about the the involvement of people who have training and who understand the history of thought behind what people are doing in their lives so that they can apply that history and further it through this data.
From what you're looking at, and you're the chief analyst of all this data at OkCupid and looking at a lot beyond, are we better or worse than we thought from the way we presented ourselves?
Probably worse. I mean, I will definitely say working at OkCupid has made me a lot more cynical, unfortunately. You know, when there's none of this kind of social desirability bias, or you're not inhibited by what anyone thinks of you, it's just you and the computer, people indulge their darker side. The one good thing about this data is it lets us see that darker side, brings it to light, maybe airs it out a little bit.
Of course, maybe that changes us as well. I mean, if we've always been hemmed in a little bit for the better by our social relationships, and those are taken down when we're just alone with the keyboard, maybe human nature itself ends up changing a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. That's a kind of time question that can only be answered by time.
Christian Rutter, a co-founder of OkCupid, president there, and author of the new book, Dataclism: Who We Are When We Think No One's Looking. Christian, good luck. We'll check in with you in a couple of years, see how the flood is going.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for joining us. Listeners, same to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for being with us. This is On Point.